The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey, it's time for another Saturday Classic, where we dig into the back catalog and we reshare an older episode. And today that episode is the Emu War.
This is one of the topics that we continue to get requests for. And while it's nice to be able to answer those emails with a wish that is already granted when we send the URL of that existing episode, we thought we would spread the news far and wide that yes, there is an episode about the Emu War. I will also say that we know that in Australia, people say emu as Holly just did. However, in the United States, many people say emu as I just did.
Yeah,
we got a lot of email about this fact when this episode originally came out.
Yeah, so just enjoy the birds and don't get too worried about how we pronounce it. We know both are acceptable in different places. And this war, and I have to use the air quotes, was an initiative in Australia in the 1930s to control the emu population. There were soldiers and guns and hunting. It was a big adventure, but ultimately it was a really embarrassing affair. So enjoy!
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
And today we have an episode that is right from the suggestion box.
Yes,
it is from the Twitter user NT Purvis, who asked us if we could please talk about the Emu War of 1932. That referenced it as one of the most bizarre wildlife management stories. I would like to just go ahead and put it out there. Yes.
Correct.
That's completely accurate. But it's also a story that needs a little bit of context.
After World War I, there were a lot of soldiers in Australia, both Australian and British, and they moved to rural parts of the country as part of a rural settlement effort described as a state scheme, this is in quotes, a state scheme intended to turn swords into plowshares by Murray Johnson in the Journal of Australian Studies.
Yeah, so the government purchased about 90,000 hectares of land. And much of it was not actually very good for farmland. There's a lot of land in Australia, but a lot of it does not work for, quote, conventional farming very well. And that puts a high demand on the parts that are going to be the best for farming. So a lot of the soldiers wound up in more of the marginal areas that weren't actually that great for farming. So they were already set up to have some challenges in their farming work.
And in particular, in the Campion-Walgoolan district, which is northeast of Perth in Western Australia, the population was largely soldier settlers, many of whom were growing wheat.
and about 5,000 of them were trying their hand at agricultural work as part of soldier settlement. Many hedged their bets, using their land for mixed farming, like they would try to grow wheat and produce wool at the same time. And when the price of one commodity went down, sometimes they could make up the difference with the other thing that they were working on.
Yeah, so in spite of the fact that a lot of this was not really prime farmland, through the 1920s, things had gone pretty well. They'd had several good seasons in a row, but by the time the 30s rolled around, things started to go south a little bit. They were becoming a little strained. Commodity prices were dropping. Droughts had become really common. There was a lot of problem with rabbit infestation. And even when things had been better, sometimes there had already been problems with really hard frosts and the rabbits. We will talk about the rabbits again in a future episode, yes, because there's a whole other story there.
And then, of course, the Great Depression happened.
Yes.
And the value for many of Australia's goods was really dropping, and the deficit was out of control in a hurry. The Australian government, which was under Prime Minister James Scullin at the time, used the country's wheat farming as an attempt to prevent the financial disaster that was falling upon all of them. And under the Grow More Wheat campaign, the government had actually promised a price of 4 shillings per bushel for wheat. The idea was that the government could use wheat to offset the collapsing price of other goods.
Right. And people were really tempted by this idea of 4 shillings a bushel. Getting a guaranteed price for something was great and unexpected. It was a better price than they could really expect other places. But unfortunately, after this deal had been promoted to everyone, the price of wheat started collapsing too. And the price of wheat had already declined just tremendously when the wheat marketing bill, which would have actually gotten the money that had been promised to the farmers, was voted down in the Senate on July 4th, 1930. So people had been expecting that they could grow all this wheat, sell it guaranteed 4 shillings a bushel, and then the funding essentially fell through when the bill was voted down. It was a hugely important bill, especially in Western Australia, where these particular farmers were living. It was so important that there were talks of Western Australian secession from the rest of Australia as the debate was going on. One of the people making this sort of threat was Mr. H. Gregory of West Australia in the House of Representatives, who said that Western Australia was going to have way more difficulty than any other Australian state if the farmers didn't get their money for their wheat.
There were other initiatives attempted to try to make good on the promise, either by Australia or by the individual states, but they just could not get off the ground. Another bill to pay 3 shillings per bushel was passed, but by then the situation was so dire and the country was having so many fiscal issues that they didn't have the money to actually pay it. It was just words.
Right. The price of wheat kept falling during the Depression. The farmers were becoming angrier and more frustrated because they were waiting for this higher price that the government had promised them while watching the market price fall. So they were losing the ability to cut their losses the longer they waited on the government to pay them. At one point, they got so frustrated that they even stopped loading their grain in an attempt to force the government to pay up. It was sort of effectively the same thing as going on strike, but that didn't work.
And finally, the Wheat Bounty Act was passed on November 25th of 1931, and that paid 4.5 pence per bushel on all wheat marketed in 1931 and 1932, and other relief measures did follow.
These measures, unfortunately, did not offer that much actual relief. It's a little hard to compare because Australian money was not on the decimal system at the time. Now Australian money is on the dollar. But there are 20 shillings in a pound and 240 pence in a pound. So to drop from 4 shillings to 4.5 pence per bushel is incredible.
That's a pretty significant tank at that
right.
point.
So that's the context. You have all of these farmers who have been farming all of this wheat. They're desperate to be able to sell their wheat for something. All the government's efforts to be able to pay them money have pretty much fallen through. They're now sort of scraping together this tiny, tiny amount per bushel. This is what's going on when, just before the 1932 wheat harvest, the emus came.
So a little bit of background in case you don't know what an emu is.
Which I found out some people I know who are smart did not. So that's where we're spelling this out.
That's surprising because we actually have emus in Georgia.
Yeah.
There are places, it's apparently a very hospitable environment for them.
So it's a large ostrich-like flightless bird that's native to Australia. It's about 1.5 meters, which is 5 feet tall, and 45 kilograms or 100 pounds. So a big flightless bird. Some species have been exterminated by settlers and are extinct. The ones that are left can run really fast. They kick when they're cornered, and they like to eat fruit, insects, and wheat, it turns out. They generally migrate kind of westward out of drier areas and towards the coast after their breeding season. Rabbit-proof fences that are in parts of Australia that were built between 1901 and 1907 keep them away from much of the coast. But it runs sort of north-south. And even though they're migrating westward, they're also going northward. So they're pretty much running the same direction as the fence is going. So there's not a lot of protection offered with this fence. It also turns out that they're wily, which people were not expecting when they concocted this plan.
Emus had been protected under the Game Act of 1874, but in 1918, new legislation, which went into effect in 1922, actually listed them as vermin because of their really devastating effect on wheat farms.
Yes. So, 1932, 20,000 giant, kicking, running bird vermin descended upon the wheat farms. It was not good for anyone. They were making their way through farms around Campion and Walgoolan, which are east and northeast of Perth, as we said before, causing huge damage to the wheat farms. And some of the soldier settlers were like, we remember a very effective weapon from World War I, and we're going to go ask if we can get help. So they went to Sir George Pierce, who was the Minister of Defense, and said, we would like the military's help with this emu problem.
And said, can we have some machine guns, please?
Yes.
Which we laugh, but it's like, it's just one of those things that seems so extreme. It's almost hard to process. Like,
and
I want to fight a bird. Let me get some heavy artillery.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But it really was that dire at that point.
It was. People were really desperately seeking help at this point. Pierce agreed that he was going to send some soldiers. There were some conditions, though. Local defense personnel, not civilians, had to be there to man the machine guns. There had to be a commanding officer present. The state of Western Australia would have to pay for the troop transport, and the soldier settlers would have to provide the housing and the ammo and the food for the troops. He did all of this without informing the military board.
Colonel Hode of the 1st Cavalry Division in Sydney had also requested 100 emu skins with the hope of using feathers for his light horseman's hat. So the troops really, like, they felt like they had put a plan together that was going to work.
Yes.
They thought success was imminent.
Yes, and inevitable. They were going to just be able to slaughter emus, retrieve their skins.
Sell
everybody
those
would
off.
Be happy. Major GPW Meredith was the commander of the 7th Heavy Battery, and he was in charge of this event. Also, to quote Murray Johnson, who we referenced earlier, Sergeant McMurray and Gunner O'Halloran and their equipment, consisting of 2 Lewis machine guns and 10,000 rounds of ammunition. Their task force was also joined by a Fox Movietone cinematographer to record the forthcoming campaign, which suggests that someone in authority, possibly Pierce, saw direct military activity in the Wheatlands as useful government propaganda. So we've got the major, the sergeant, the gunner, and a movie team coming to Western Australia. They were in Western Australia already, but coming to this part of Western Australia to kill emus and film it.
How could this go anyway other than success? Just for context, the Lewis machine gun is a light machine gun. It was invented by U.S. Colonel Isaac Newton Lewis, and it was used extensively by the British Empire in World War I. It has a flat pan magazine on top instead of a belt feed, as you might imagine. You can actually look up YouTube videos of this and see what we're talking about. It's kind of fascinating the way it feeds through.
Yeah. It's like a big flat pan of ammunition that sits on top.
Yeah, where the ammo is actually loaded into the pan, almost like the rays of the sun, if you were drawing like a childish drawing of the sun.
Yeah.
And then you flip it onto the machine gun and it feeds from that pan rather than, we've all seen in films, like those long...
The belt feed.
Yep. But it doesn't work like that.
No. This team arrived in early October. But just after they got there, a rainstorm drove all the emus out of the fields for long enough that they said, okay, this is actually, we're not worth waiting around here. We're going to go home. When the emus came back about a month later, Major Meredith and his team came back as well. And they arrived at the fields near Campion on November 2nd at about the same time as a herd of about 50 emus. The problem was that the emus were out of range of the machine guns, and some soldiers tried to come and herd the emus toward the guns,
which was not all that effective. They finally did manage to strike a few birds as they were fleeing for the cover of nearby trees. And they actually made a base camp on the land of a man named Joseph Joyce, and they did recon on the surrounding farms for emu activity. They managed to take out about a dozen birds before deciding to change their tactics from seek out and shoot to set ambushes near water sources.
Right. The ambush strategy was a little more successful than the seek and shoot strategy, but not really by much. November 3rd passed without any kind of incident. On November 4th, about 1,000 emus came out of the trees and approached the ambush directly. The ambush was set on the walls of a dam, and the machine gunners opened fire and hit a few birds before the machine gun jammed. The settlers who were assisting with this operation opened fire with their rifles, but by that point the birds were scattering and running for the tree line. They waited for the rest of the day for the birds to come back to this watering hole. When they didn't come back, everybody started to get the idea that maybe these emus were a little smarter than they had thought.
Yeah, they didn't count on them using the logic of, that thing is dangerous, I will stay away from it.
Let's not go back there.
And so they moved their operation south, and they tried to mount a Lewis machine gun onto a truck so that they could fire while driving and hit emus that were on the move. But the emus outran them and escaped into the trees, and the gunner found the ride so rough that he really wasn't able to fire the machine gun anyway.
Now, elsewhere on the same day, a truck ran down an emu, hit it, ran out of control, and destroyed a long length of fence. So the battle against the emus was not really going very well anywhere that day. By the 8th of November, Major Meredith's team had used about a quarter of their ammunition, which was about 2,500 rounds, and with that they had killed 200 emus. Meredith later called it 300, and the soldier settlers rounded it up to 500, maybe to raise their spirits. They were the ones paying for the ammo. So the idea that such a tiny proportion of ammo was actually killing emus was a little distressing when they were the ones paying for the bullets.
And then on November 9th,
yes,
word actually got to Parliament about what was going on when Parliament member Harold Thornby actually asked Prime Minister Lyons about the farce that was going on in Western Australia. That same day, the Secretary of Defense sent a telegram ordering the operation to end.
Yes, this is an example of we would rather ask for forgiveness than permission did not work out, because having not asked for permission, they were ordered to return home. It was not a successful attempt.
Well, and it most likely actually made things worse, since the fleeing emus then, not only had they been eating wheat, but now they were trampling crops.
Right.
So the soldier settlers, though, continued to ask for aid, and Meredith's report spoke of the extensive damage that the emus had done.
He also explained, as best as he could, why he had used so much ammo on so few birds, and these are his words. It must be realized that an emu full out can do 45 miles an hour. Consequently, the target is, after the first burst, a very rapidly moving one, and is only visible for a very short time. Moreover, the emu is an amazingly hard bird to kill outright, and many carry mortal wounds up to the distance of half a mile on actual observation. Much later in this campaign, a farmer named A.E. Johnson killed an emu with his truck, and that bird had 5 bullets in his body, which appeared to have been from the first onslaught. So this emu was still alive days after being shot with multiple rounds.
Yeah, it had survived and was just carrying around metal while it ran about its business.
Yes.
People in the government appeared to try to distance themselves from the idea of a second campaign. And the Minister of Defense finally said that no military personnel could be placed there, but that the state government could have equipment if it found its own qualified operators. So they didn't want to waste man hours, but they were willing to offer them the materials needed to continue trying to fight the emus on their own. But there were no experienced machine gunners in the civil service list. So it was back to Meredith and team, who were being lampooned as Major Meredith and his merry men.
They came back to the area and launched a second offensive on November 13th, and they used Joseph Joyce's property as their starting point again. They killed about 25 emus on November 13th and about 20 more the day after. At about this time, an animal welfare officer was sent to oversee the reports that so many birds were apparently being injured and then continuing to run.
it's not likely that he was able to do that much.
So he was basically there to try to ensure that the animals weren't suffering, that they were being hit and killed and not needlessly carrying on in an inhumane way.
Right. That was his role, but it's unlikely that it actually made much of an effect. By November 15th, the birds had started to become really cautious of the soldiers' activities, which I think people weren't quite expecting them to learn from experience. They would stay out of range of the machine gun. So they were smarter than people thought.
Yeah, they were learning range distance and where was safe and where wasn't.
Right. Like
they had boundaries in their head of how close they could get.
Right.
The team moved around the area as various farmers would report to them that they had seen emus and had crop damage. And by December 2nd, they were pretty consistently killing, by reports, about 100 emus a week.
Yeah, that's what they were telling people.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials... cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brigadier Martin recalled Major Meredith on December 10th. In Martin's reports, he gave an estimated 986 birds killed and 9,860 bullets used. That's a suspicious accounting of birds versus bullets. And
that is just multiplying by 10.
Yes. There was an ongoing attempt to get the soldier settlers to repay the military for that ammunition. The way that it went down is that the agricultural bank reimbursed the military on the soldiers' behalf, and then the bank put off asking the soldiers to repay them until 1933 because they knew times were hard for everybody. Eventually, T.E. Dixon, who was the president of the Wheat Growers Union at Campion, got a demand for 35 pounds. And Daniel O'Leary, who was an executive member of the Walgulin Wheat Growers Union, got a demand for 24 pounds.
O'Leary eventually got his payment reduced, though, to £1.14. He did not want to pay anything and countered with an accounting of how much money he had spent personally on the effort, including £9 for victualling His Majesty's troops, £10 for transport, with a further £5 for damage to same, and £900 for the loss of 6,000 bushels of wheat, valued at 3 shillings per bushel. The whole thing remained suspended, and many sources don't show that anybody ever actually got paid, that no money changed hands for reimbursement.
No. Even though this is pretty roundly seen as an unsuccessful attempt to curb the population of emus, Western Australians continued to ask for military help again. In 1934, 1938, and 1943, the military turned down the request all three times. The soldier settlers used their own arms to fight the emus instead. O'Leary, who we mentioned a few minutes ago, in 1943 also mentioned getting an RSPCA letter about their destruction of the emus and how it was cruel. His response was that they were going to defend their crops and they did not need anyone's permission.
And after World War II, farmers were actually issued free ammunition for dealing with vermin. 284,704 emus were known to have been killed by farmers between 1945 and 1960, so in just 15 years' time.
Right. So it seems like while the firing of machine guns at herds of emus, not very successful as an attempt to control their population, people have been able to do a little better with a rifle sort of singling out one at a time. There are still lots and lots of emus in Australia. Their population now is controlled by a bounty. There are payments given for between 5,000 and 40,000 birds a year in Western Australia. Even though there are that many being shot, reportedly their population are still pretty healthy. It's sort of like the idea of if the bird is really being a pest and it's not negatively affecting their overall population to the point of threatening them to be able to keep them out of farmlands, then generally, people seem to be okay with the situation.
Yeah, it's always, you know, as a compassionate human being, it's always hard to think about animals being killed. But this is one of those cases where the government is really trying to balance the health of the animal population and the welfare of the human population. And it's tricky. There's no easy answer, really, that's going to make everybody happy. So that's where they've landed, is with bounty.
Right. So, that one attempt, 1932.
They fought a battle.
They fought a battle. And at the time, things were hard in the Great Depression. People really took the opportunity to lampoon the military and the government when that was going on. It became a source of entertainment for people, which people kind of needed then. And it was nice for people to have a government target that they could laugh at, when people felt like the government was taking a lot of blame for what was going on in the community at the time. So that's the story
of the Emu War.
Of the Emu War, the brief and indeed bizarre wildlife management attempt in Western Australia.
since these episodes that we're sharing are past classics, we have some updated information that will supersede the contact stuff you've heard before. If you want to email us, our email address is historypodcast@howstuffworks.com, and you can find us across the spectrum of social media as Missed in History. You can also find us at missedinhistory.com, and you can visit our parent company, How Stuff Works, at howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.